Hello there, and welcome to Woman of Grit, a podcast that holds space for women to have authentic conversations about our intersectional challenges and where we elevate women's voices, celebrate their strengths, and honor their resilience. I'm your host, Dr. Ann, the Gritpreneur and Woman of Grit. Come on in. We saved a seat at the table for you.
Today's guest leads an ordinary life filled with extraordinary moments. She's a wife, mother to six children, and let's not forget her three dogs, and a serial entrepreneur who splits her time between her family, businesses, and personal growth. She is the author of a best-selling book called The Extraordinary Unordinary You, in which she details her adoption journey, climbing Mount Kilimanjaro, and many funny, scary, and inspiring stories that came along the way. Let's meet Simone Pinego. Hello, Simone. Welcome to Woman of Grit podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me here today.
No worries. I'll just dive right in. In your book, The Extraordinary Unordinary You, you advise readers to identify their passions and pursue them with enthusiasm, as doing what you love can lead to a fulfilling life. This is really a two-part question. The first part is, why did you write this book in the first place?
So I started doing some public speaking through a volunteer position. And I think for a long time, I didn't realize that I had a story. You know, I had a lot going on, but I didn't feel like I was making a difference in the world. And through that volunteer opportunity and through sharing my stories as a speaker, I started realizing, wait, maybe I do have a story. And so many people said to me, have you written a book? They've asked me, have you written a book? No, I haven't written a book. Again, limiting myself, not thinking that I'm a writer. I went to school to be an accountant. I was a CPA when I first started. And then I realized that, you know, why not write a book? I have these great stories. Let me put them down on paper. So that's kind of the simple answer to why I wrote it.
You had something to contribute as an author. So the second part of that question is, what is the first step that someone should take if they want to pursue their passions, but they're not sure what their passions are?
So I think the first thing is really asking yourself what you want. I think so many times we tell ourselves that we can't do something. We feel we're intimidated by something. We're limited by fear. And I think most of the time, if we take a step back and say, if fear wasn't an issue, then what would we be capable of doing? And that's kind of how it started for me, is I said, okay, let me leave everything out there. Let me not worry about if I'm going to fail, because failure is part of the process. It was, what do I want to do? And there's a lot of things I didn't want to do. And a lot of the things that I was currently doing were things that I really didn't want to do, but I felt like I had to do them. And so it was taking that step back to say, are these things really important? Are these the things I want to be doing? And that's kind of what changed it for me.
So you prioritize the things that were important in your life. And so somebody listening, that would be something you want to do. Look and see what is important to you and prioritize those things and actually start doing them. So you encourage readers to embrace their unique qualities and not to be afraid to stand out from the crowd, because our differences are what make us extraordinary. How can someone embrace their differences when it seems like society is pressuring us, you know, to conform to a norm? How do we go about that?
Yeah, so I am a big believer in that we all are unique and that we all need to embrace exactly who we are. We're all making a difference by being unique. And that's why I say unordinary, right? None of us are ordinary. I used to call myself an ordinary. I'm just an ordinary girl, limiting myself by saying just, right? I'm just a housewife. I'm just a stay-at-home mom. Whatever it was, that was kind of how I was limiting myself. And, You know, I think that there's so much that we can do. We're all different from each other in every way, shape, or form. If I look at my children, every single one of them is completely different. But but the reason they're different and what makes them different is what makes them unique and so special. And yeah, society wants us to become the norm. Well, what is the norm? What is normal, right? There isn't normal. So it really, for me, it's about looking at yourself and saying, I am unique and this is what makes me special, and not worrying about what anybody else is thinking. If I'm moving forward with kindness and empathy and I feel like I'm doing good things in the world, then I shouldn't worry about what anybody else is thinking.
Yeah, thank you for that answer. So your book also emphasizes the importance of surrounding yourself with positive, supportive people. But what if someone is surrounded by negative people who are not supportive? How can they create a more positive environment for themselves in all that negativity?
So I think open communication is the biggest piece. For a long time, I too was surrounded by people who were quite toxic, and I just kind of got caught up in it. And I was always a people pleaser. I was the person that I was a fixer. I wanted to make sure everyone was happy. That's not reality. I mean, we have to look at ourselves and say, when I'm with these people, do I feel good about myself? Do I feel like I'm being enhanced by the people I'm surrounded by, or are they bringing me down? And yes, I mean, the hardest thing you can do is to say, I don't want to hang out with these people anymore. I don't want to be surrounded by these people anymore. But I think the first step is actually having a conversation of, when something is said, you put the question back on that person, like, why would you say something like that? Or why, you know, why every time I'm, you know, talking about something, do you say something negative about what I'm doing?
Right.
And a lot of times when you put the question back on that person, they didn't even realize that they were behaving that way.
Right.
And then obviously if it doesn't work, then it's really going to the, you know, cutthroat thing and saying, this isn't good for me. This isn't good for my family. And I don't want to become the person that they are. I don't want to start being negative about everything around me.
I totally get that. You know, it said you are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. So if communication does not do it, at some point you have to remove yourself from that environment, because you don't want to become the average of the negativity, of the toxicity. You also encourage readers to identify their purpose in life and work towards achieving their goals. What advice do you have for someone who is feeling a little lost, or just plain lost, or unsure of which direction to take in their life?
I think a lot of people feel lost, and I know I felt lost for a really long time. I've tried many things in my life. I started off as a CPA. Then I had a horse farm. I taught horseback riding lessons. I ran a summer camp. I went back to school to be a teacher. I worked in sales. I'm a big believer in that it's okay to change your mind and it's okay to try different things. So it's not like, okay, today I have this job and I'm going to quit it and I'm going to start this tomorrow and that's going to be exactly my purpose in life. I really think it's a process of trying different things. If we don't try, how do we know what we're going to like? And just because someone else likes it doesn't mean we have to like it. We shouldn't limit ourselves because we're afraid of trying these things, and that we're afraid we're going to fail if we try them.
And I think that is also part of having a growth mindset, not being afraid of failure, because people with fixed mindsets tend to not try new things because they don't want to fail. They are comfortable doing the things that they know they're going to succeed at. And, you know, that's why I raised my child. I make him know you can change your mind. You can pivot. You can start over. You can go in a different direction. It is okay. Because until you try something, like you said, how do you know you like it? How do you know you don't like it? Which reminds me of my father. You know, when we were growing up, we'd sit at the table, and if there was a new food, he had one rule. You had to try first before you made a decision about liking it or not liking it. So if you did a taste test and you did not like it, then he was okay with you not eating whatever it was, but try it first before you make a decision. So thank you for that answer. Also, talking about your book, you acknowledge that life is full of challenges and you encourage readers to view their challenges as opportunities for growth and learning. What advice do you have for someone listening who is currently facing a challenge in their life? What do you have to say to them?
So part of challenges is the learning piece, right? I mean, if we don't go through a challenge, how do we expand? How do we become even stronger than we are today? And I still remember with my kids, anytime they had a situation where they did bad on a test and they thought it was going to be the end of the world. And,
yeah.
And I'm like, this is not the end of the world. This is just the beginning. But this is how you learn, right? There are so many challenges that people face every single day. And if we got stuck in that challenge, we're not able to move forward. And
right.
In the moment, it seems like the most difficult thing you're ever going to have to deal with. But once you pass through that challenge, pass over that challenge, it's in the past, right? It's done. And you learn from it and you move forward. And I'm not saying it's easy right at that moment. At that moment, it's extremely difficult. But know that there is something better, something more exciting in the future.
Right.
And also that you're not alone. I think that's the one of the biggest thing is I think sometimes we look at the world
support.
And think that we're the only one that struggles. And that is not true at all. I don't know of one person who hasn't struggled. So when we look at that as a whole and we say, we are not alone, I think it's a comforting factor of saying, okay, I'm able to move through this and then tomorrow is going to be better and the next day is going to be even better. And, you know, that's how I've gotten through my challenges.
Right. So thank you for that. So in our challenges, we grow, you know, we grow. I always say we do not grow in our comfort zone.
No, you can't grow in your comfort zone.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And, you know, this reminds me of my young man. He's 17 now. Last August, he tore his ACL. He plays sports track and then also plays football. And we went to see the orthopedic surgeon and he looked at the MRI and he did confirm that the ACL was gone. He was going to need surgery. And I remember he stepped out of the room, leaving the two of us together. And he just broke down. He's in the 11th grade. He was everything to him. He was going to have a breakout year. I didn't know what to do. I had to call his coach. I said, could you please talk to him? Because he was despondent. Because I think at that moment for him, it was over. It was just over. And so his coach talked to him, gave him examples of people who had been injured, who had recovered. And we're 6 months out, going into the 7th month of recovery, and he actually has grown. Oh my gosh, he has grown during this challenge. I mean, the teenager who went into this challenge is not the young man who is coming out of this challenge. I mean, certainly we don't want bad things to happen, but when they do happen, you take it, learn the lessons from it, and you move forward.
We had the same situation, although my son was in 10th grade when it happened. He tore his ACL, MCL, and meniscus. And
oh my gosh.
And so he had to have surgery and he thought that was going to be the end of all of it. And so it took 6 months. And then we found out he actually had a shoulder tear as well, which was like a genetic issue. And he had that repaired. So he was out for almost a year. This past season, he just is graduating in 2 weeks from high school. And this past lacrosse season was his best season ever.
And I think that the mindset, when they make it through this, they really just become tougher people. So let's pivot, you know, the tallest peak in Africa. And it's believed to be a place of great power and energy. And many people feel a deep connection to the mountain. For some, the climb is a spiritual journey. My cousin, Nadia, she did it with her former classmates from boarding school in Kenya. They all did it to honor their PE teacher. So they decided to climb Kilimanjaro. You also climbed Kilimanjaro. What was your motivation?
So The funny story about it is that my husband was actually asked to climb. A friend of ours had climbed it the year before, and he called my husband and said, hey, they're putting together another team to climb next year. They were raising money for the Livestrong Foundation. And so he said to my husband, are you interested? And of course, the way I tell the story is 1, 2, 3, no, thank you, call Simone. And so his friend called me and asked me if I was interested. And I said, I am interested, actually. This is completely out of my comfort zone. I am not an athlete. I have never climbed anything. I've gone camping. And I said, I think I want to do this for myself. It's something where I know that if I believe in myself and I really push myself, that I can accomplish this. And that was a big stretch for me because I struggled for years to believe in myself. And this mountain was a turning point for me across the board. And so I trained for about 9 months, 6 to 9 months that I was able to train for because by the time I registered, I didn't have that much time. But I did it. I worked out every day. I got myself in shape and I went with 16 other people who were complete strangers. I met them when I landed in Tanzania and it was really a magical spiritual experience for me and really a moment of growth. And I can't tell you how many people would come up to me, people that I knew quite well, and would say to me, do you really think you're going to make it to the top?
Oh, my goodness.
And my answer was like, no, I think I'm going to make it halfway. That's why I'm doing it. So when you talk about people surrounding you, the naysayers, right?
And yes, absolutely.
Yes, of course I think I'm going to make it to the top. That's why I'm doing this. I'm pushing myself. I believe in myself. And and that was kind of a turning point for me where when I got to the summit and I said to myself, this is what happens when you believe in yourself and you put in the work to do it and you stop listening to the naysayers around you.
Sometimes it really baffles me. Because there's an alternative to, are you really going to make it? You think you should be doing this. There's an alternative, which is quite easy, which is cheap. It's not expensive. Go, Simone.
Right. Words matter.
So what did this experience teach you? You already talked about it, you know, just previously. What did it teach you about yourself? And how has it changed your perspective on life in general?
It really taught me a lot about myself, really going back to the resilience, perseverance. And even when we look at ourselves in the mirror and say, oh, I could never do this. Instead of saying you can't do something, now it's ask yourself if you want to, right? Because just like what we said a few minutes ago about words matter, I've had a lot of people say to me, oh, I could never do that. And my question would be, well, would you want to? No, I would never want to do that. And I said, okay, well, then use those words because it's not that you're not capable of doing it. You just don't want to do it.
Right.
So my perspective on a lot of things changed after that because I realized that I want to put my energy into the things that I want to do. Sure, there's things I have to do every day, you know, with kids and work. But the things that I really have a choice about, I want to do the things that I really want to do. So that really kind of changed my mindset. And I did realize that I was capable of accomplishing things that I never thought I would be able to do because of, and again, it's not just setting the goal, it's putting the work in behind the goal. Right. And I think the last thing is really having my kids see that they can do whatever they want to do as well. And this was another question I got from a lot of people. Isn't this selfish for you to leave your family for 2 weeks? And I said, actually, it's called self-care. It makes me a better human doing something for myself, especially something that could potentially inspire my children to want to do things like this for themselves.
Right. Absolutely. I'm prior military and I had to leave my 1-year-old to deploy. And I think it was probably harder on me than it was on him because being so young. But I think the growth that happened with you facing that mountain, climbing that mountain, I think it's for the benefit of your family. You know, when I came back from Iraq, I just had a new perspective on life. There were just some things that were not worth my time and effort, things that I used to stress about. And I just decided, you know, I'm not going to be bothered by that. So I'm going to go in a little further. So just give us what it was like. The training you did, Was there specialized training and thinking altitude and things like that? All your training, was it here in the US? Give us an idea of what the preparation was like for you.
Absolutely. So I live in Florida. Obviously, it's very flat here. So I kind of had to like make up mountains. So we have one bridge in Sarasota, and I used to wear my pack and my boots, because that's the most important thing, is to make sure that your boots are properly worn in so that you're not going to get blisters as soon as you start. And I literally would be on that bridge and do it multiple times a week so that I could at least get a little bit of elevation in. The other thing I did was I went and trained stairs. So at the hospital, you know, it's multi-story, so I could go up and down the stairs in the parking garage. And I'm sure people were like, what is this woman doing? But it didn't matter. I mean, it's kind of what helped me. The other thing was I had this really special mask. And it's funny, these days I could wear it and people would be like, oh, she's just wearing a mask. But it's called an elevation training mask. And it has these valves on the side where you can adjust the amount of air that you're able to bring into your lungs. So it helps with lung capacity. Obviously, it doesn't help with the chemical change that happens when you're at a high altitude. But it definitely built my lung capacity to the point where I could really hold my breath for a serious amount of time underwater, which I could never do before. Where I trained for it. And so I used to wear that. I used to do boxing with a personal trainer. And so I would wear that in a boxing session. And oh my gosh, there was probably nothing more difficult that I've done in exercise than that, because you're now sucking in air that you can set it up to like 15,000 feet. And so you're sucking in this tiny little bit of air and you're trying to get your body to do these things that it shouldn't be happening. For me, it worked out really well. I really had no issues when I was on the mountain, other than I have had a couple of knee surgeries. So on the way back down, my knee was incredibly swollen.
Right. And you know, my cousin told me it was harder for her coming down than it was even going up. I mean, like just coming down, making sure you didn't fall. What was your experience?
So on the mountain itself, definitely for me, the hardest part was coming down. Plus you do it a lot faster. So the going up, obviously you're trying to acclimate to the altitude. You're taking a little bit more time. On the way down, you're like, we're done. We need to get out of there. And so you come down quite quickly, which is not the easiest thing because your body is exhausted at this point.
Right.
But I think really the hardest part was the last night you leave after dark to start climbing up so that you get to the first summit. So there's actually three peaks. So
I was reading that.
Yeah, you get to the first one at sunrise or right before sunrise. And so you're in the dark. So first of all, you're exhausted to begin with. And a lot of people have asked me, well, did you take oxygen? You can't, because you can't carry enough oxygen. The summit attempt goes from a little bit over 15,000 feet to the 19,341 feet. There's no way you would have a bottle of oxygen that could last that long. But in general, I felt like I was pretty well prepared. Considering coming from Florida, I felt that I really did a good job with the exercise portion. Sure, if I had three more months, I probably could have been in even better shape. But I was able to put one foot in front of the other and get it done.
You did it.
I did it.
I think that is the important thing, that you did it. You signed up for it, you trained for it, you went there, and you did it. And that is really important. If not, I mean, like you say, setting a good example for your children, but also setting a good example for yourself. Sometimes I flake out on myself. And so that was really good that you followed through. So let's talk about adoption.
Absolutely.
I see that picture behind you, and clearly something is different about your family, is multicultural. What made you go down that road, adoption?
Yeah. So originally, we had discussed adoption between our first two children. So they're almost 4 years apart. And I was having a hard time getting pregnant. And so we talked about it. And then, of course, as soon as we really talked about it, then I found out I was pregnant. And after we had our third child, I remember having this picture taken of the three oldest. And I still have it hanging on the wall going up our stairs. And I always would look at that picture and feel like something was missing. And I was not a good pregnant person. So when I first brought it up with my husband, I think we should have another child. He's like, oh my gosh, really? You want to be pregnant again? I was like, no, let's go back to our conversation from years ago about adopting. He's like, okay, that I'm willing to discuss. The more we looked into it, and we still believe that there are just so many amazing kids in the world just waiting for a family to love them. And we knew we wanted to be one of those families that built our family in a different way than a lot of people do.
Traditional, supposedly.
Yes, the normal.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So what were some of the challenges when you decided, you talked about it with your husband, he was on board, and now you had to start the process? Had you done any research before that time, the first time you guys talked about it? Or did you start from scratch and start looking into adoption? And how was that process for you?
We had done a little bit of research, but it was really... it's a big process. It's getting your family on board. So it's really wasn't just about my husband and I. It was about our other children as well, because as they say, it takes a village to raise a child. And in this case, you know, we wanted to make sure that the kids were involved in the process with us. So for each adoption, we actually took a vote, a blind vote, where they wrote down yes or no, because we wanted to make sure it was unanimous, because if any of us had reservations about what we're doing or why we're doing it, we really wanted to discuss it and kind of make sure we were hearing what the kids had to say. But that never was an issue. They all said yes. And I'm sure at first it was like, okay, this is really cool. We're going to have a new sibling.
Right.
But then it became even more than that for them. And the process is tedious. I still have saved every piece of paperwork, and it is stacks and stacks of paperwork. And now it's different. I'm sure it's different because everything is probably electronic, right? And so you're not waiting by the mailbox. You're not waiting for the phone call. You get everything probably much quicker. I don't know if you get the, you know, when you're matched with a child, if that happens quicker, but I think that probably the paperwork process is a little bit maybe less tedious. And I don't want to assume that, but it was a big process, and it took a lot of time to complete. And, you know, the other thing is you think about, am I making the right choice, right? Not necessarily for us, but for this child. So,
absolutely.
Especially building a family that's a multicultural family. Are we taking something away from them? And, you know, when we talked about it, the more we talked about it was like, we didn't make the choice for our child to be relinquished. We made the choice to bring a child into our family, and we're going to do the best we can. And no matter what, love them to the moon and back. And that was kind of what we committed to.
So what are some of the challenges in that multicultural, world? I know the challenges I have as a mom to a Black son, and all that worry I have about him and his safety. What is it like for you? How do those conversations go? So we have the talk. My son is 17. He's going to start driving. And he knows unequivocally my ultimate for him is to come home. Whatever it takes. There's no ego in anything. Just make it home. So we've had that talk. We've had the talk. How has it been for you?
So we have to have the talk as well. And I've said before that I can never say that I could understand what a Black mother goes through, but I can understand what a mother goes through raising Black children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's things that I never had to do with my oldest son, and especially with talking my son who's from Ethiopia and my son that's biologic. So my son who's biologic, I taught him how to drive and, hey, be polite, be, you know, all these things. And be responsible, right? And now it's a completely different ball game. It's if you're ever pulled over, you know, we're like, if you say to Siri, hey Siri, I'm being pulled over, start recording.
Right.
It will start recording. It's things that like I never would have had to think about, right? And it's a sad world.
You know what? Just that thought. He has an iPhone. I'm writing that down.
Yeah.
Hey Siri, start recording.
Yep. And it's you know, it's scary as a mom. That's my big thing is that I say to him, when I need to know when you're coming home, you know, and it's heartbreaking. That's where we still are.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't be there at all, but that's where we still are. Mm-hmm. And so fortunately, I kind of want to knock on wood, but we haven't had any car issues, but we have had issues on a jet ski. So we used to have a jet ski. We don't have it anymore, but he got his boater's license. The first time he took it out, he wasn't even a couple hundred feet from the house, and he got pulled over. And when he got pulled over, and of course, he's like going the speed of a snail because it's his first time out and he's nervous and he wants to make sure he doesn't break the rules. And so he got asked for his boater's license, his driver's license, and he had to point out the house that he lived in. Right. And the police officer wrote him a warning for going too fast in a no wake zone. And he wasn't in a no wake zone. It was just he has been pulled over so many times on the jet ski. And I said to him, I said, so why did you get pulled over? He's like, take a look around, Mom. How many Black teenagers do you see on a jet ski in Sarasota?
Right.
And, you know, it's a heartbreaking thing to me that he has to do things differently. Now, his friends find it quite comical at this point because they'll be all riding together and he gets pulled over.
Every
single time. And they're just waiting
Every single time. And, you know, the thing is, you know, people, they see maybe the one video clip of it and wonder, why is he so angry? What they don't see the 99 times before, it's like, oh, tired
absolutely.
Of it. You know, so it's not, a mother is a mother, mother of a Black child. You know, people don't maybe seem to understand. When I have these conversations, I said, sometimes I lie awake at night just anxious. So the kid knows to call me, to text me. I have arrived here. I am on my way back. Estimated time of arrival. So yes, definitely. And is there anything else that you want the listeners to know? Where can they find you? What services you offer to the public? Your book, where can they buy your book? Anything like that?
Absolutely. My best way to find me is on my website, simonecanego.com. And if you search me, you will find me because I still believe I'm the only Simone Canego in the world. It's a very unique name.
And I think the combination too.
Yes, yes. Simone has become quite popular. Canego, not so much.
Not so much.
But my book is available on Amazon. A lot of online retailers have it. And it's also, I actually ended up recording an audiobook for it as well. The son that we were just speaking about, he has pretty severe dyslexia. And I thought, you know what? I need to put this out there as an audiobook because he listens to everything. I want to make sure that other people who want to listen have that opportunity.
That's a great. Did you record it yourself or did you have somebody record it?
I actually recorded it myself. And
nice.
It's funny because I do a lot of public speaking. So I thought, okay, this is easy. This will be great. And then I didn't realize this is really hard to record to record an audiobook. It's much different because you're basically talking to yourself. Mm-hmm. You don't get any feedback and then you listen and then you're, you know, quality control. It was a really interesting process for that.
That's how I feel when I'm doing a solo episode of my podcast.
Yeah.
Sometimes I just have to remind myself, smile. I'll put a little post-it notes up, you know. Smile and things like that just to keep me going.
Yeah. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. Find me. I'm working on a course right now for women that's all about helping women change the way they see themselves because I truly believe that we don't need to change who we are. We need to change the way we see ourselves because we all are so important in our world. We all add so much to other people's lives every day. We just need to take a step back and realize that.
We give value.
Yes, we all have value.
It has been, time has just flown by, absolutely flown by. It has been a pleasure having you on Woman of Grit podcast. Thank you for coming. And I never say goodbye. Until next time. So Simone Canego, thank you for coming on Woman of Grit podcast. And until next time, take care.
Until next time. Thanks so much.
All righty.
So that's it for today's episode of Woman of Grit. Thank you for joining us and don't miss the next episode in 1 week. And while you're waiting, you can catch up on previous episodes of our podcast on your favorite listening platforms, which you can access from our website, womanofgritpodcast.com. While on the website, you can learn more about today's guest and all our previous guests. Make sure to subscribe, leave a review, and rate the show to help us reach more listeners so we can continue bringing you these incredible stories of women who have overcome challenges with grit and determination. Thank you for your support, and until next week, remain ever gritful and never quit. It's always darkest before dawn, but light comes in the morning. Take care.